It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. In the whole world, there are just a few places where a confluence of environmental factors creates incredible abundance. One of those is Bristol Bay. The fisheries are the richest for commercial salmon, and for sport angling, for enormous trophy trout. The subsistence way of life is abundant with fish and game, and the area is unspoiled and beautiful, with its combination of water, land, and life. On today's show, we're exploring Bristol Bay through several of these lenses. In the first half, I'll be talking with a photographer who captured the region in a new book. In the second half, the topic is fishing, discussing the competition and drama of the drift gillnet fishery and the high-end fly fishing for trophies from a remote wilderness lodge. Well, right now I'm with Carl Johnson, who is the author of this gorgeous new book, Where Water is Gold, Life and Livelihood in Alaska's Bristol Bay. And it's a photography book. Carl is a photographer, also an attorney, and a number of really noted writers have contributed. The foreword is by none other than Sandra Day O'Connor, the first woman to serve on the Supreme Court, who I guess is a fisherman and also loves Bristol Bay. And I noted that Nick Jans has contributed an essay. He's a terrific Alaskan writer. Bill Sherwanit, who would be known to a lot of our listeners, and Aaron McKittrick. Quite a good collection of authors, but it's Carl, it's mostly a photography book. I mean, it's mostly just gorgeous pictures.
Yeah, a lot of times photography, it can tell the story just by itself, and a good photographer tries to still to take images that tell compelling stories by themselves. But to really fully appreciate the story of Bristol Bay, we felt it was really important to have some well-written, informative essays to kind of round out the story. Mm-hmm.
Well, tell me about gathering these images, because it seems to me you must have spent an awful lot of time outdoors finding some really gorgeous places to take pictures of. It's not only places, of course. There's a lot of people fishing and harvesting wildlife like moose and stuff in the book, and it's some of these photography books are just sort of gorgeous places, but you've actually included the life there too.
Yeah, that was something the publisher told me. It was the first book that Braided River had published that had so many people in it. And when I was designing my shot list for the book, kind of conceiving, you know, the kind of images I really felt I needed to capture to tell the story, a lot of them involved people, because the story of Bristol Bay is a story of the way of life in Bristol Bay. It has a very rich and long subsistence culture with customary and traditional practices, and then of course commercial fishing has a long heritage. The role of commercial fishing was what was going on pre-statehood was significant, and how we shaped our constitution, how resources were being managed. So there are some pretty, you know, locations. I want people to kind of appreciate the grandeur of the Bristol Bay region beyond some of the more iconic images they may be familiar with, like, you know, bears fishing for sockeye salmon.
Right, we've seen a lot of beautiful Alaska photography books.
But and I was very insistent with the publisher that there were no photos of Brooks Falls bears fishing for salmon, because I wanted people to get a better understanding, a broader understanding of the Bristol Bay region.
Well, let's introduce listeners to what's some of the special aspects of Bristol Bay. One, obviously, or perhaps the iconic and most important aspect of Bristol Bay to Alaskans is salmon, and in fact it's the largest salmon fishery in the world, I believe.
That's correct. 50% of all the commercially caught sockeye salmon on the planet comes from the Bristol Bay region, and principally two watersheds, the Quijack and the Nooshigak river systems.
And why so many salmon in this one region?
Well, there are a variety of conditions that provide for ideal salmon spawning. And one of the things that's particularly unique about the Bristol Bay region is a very rich interaction between groundwaters and surface waters that create really excellent overwintering population areas for the rearing smelt, and places where you get this bubbling of interaction between groundwater and surface water prevents from freezing.
So it's kind of coming up and allowing the eggs to be sort of aerated and not just freeze solid.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And fisheries biologists have even identified what's called the hyporheic zone, which is an area that's actually down in the ground where the ground and surface waters interact, where the fish will actually retreat to in the wintertime. So they'll actually go down into the groundwater, into this hyporheic zone, to retreat from freezing.
Interesting. So this that part helps account for the amazing productivity, and I imagine also just the amount of wetlands and lakes and the surface water that just across this whole region, just it's huge beyond, you know, anything else around.
Yeah, if you look at, you know, some of the aerial photos in the book, I really tried to depict just how water rich the area is. Mm-hmm. The only thing kind of closest to it that I've seen is if you're doing aerial photos up on the North Slope and that area of permafrost where you've got all that, where it's essentially a desert, but because of permafrost, all that water stands on the ground and never seeps down into the ground. Mm-hmm. So you'll see all these hexagonal shapes of all these, you know, different little wetlands areas all over the place. And Bristol Bay is very much like that. There's water everywhere.
Yeah. I think Alaskans, for the most part, are probably aware of the wealth of that fishery. And in the second half of the show, we're going to talk to commercial and sport fisher people about catching the fish. But in approaching it visually, you've also reminded us of the sort of the beauty of the fish, not only when they're swimming, but also when they are filleted. And it's this brilliant red, which is just jumps right off the page.
It is. You know, the sockeye, the red, is very well named, because I think when you look at the meats side by side with the other, you know, we have all five species of Pacific salmon that come into Bristol Bay, you know, the sockeye is the deepest, the reddest. And it's always been fun to meet people who grew up eating farmed Atlantic salmon, who don't really know what the color of salmon could look like. And then when they see a sockeye, they ask really if that's the color that it's supposed to be.
Yeah, this is the real McCoy. And I always wonder about people around the world who are eating the farm salmon that not only is not the same color, but also has a mushy consistency and a weak flavor. And wondering if they're getting used to that. I mean, if they would even like real salmon if they tasted it, you know, because it is kind of alarming that the real thing is becoming the minority and the fake is becoming the sort of the mainstream thing.
I think it's a mixed bag, because a lot of people are loath to go beyond what they're familiar with for foods, but mm-hmm. other people, like one of the chefs that I interviewed for this book, he's a well-known chef in Vegas, and he talks about, you know, he grew up eating that Atlantic salmon, and he didn't really have an appreciation for salmon until he ate a wild-caught, you know, Pacific salmon, and it really changed his worldview on salmon.
Then he realized how good it could be.
He did. And he later, you know, when he became a chef, he found it really important to model sustainable seafoods. He only would accept sustainably managed and caught seafood to use in his restaurant. And so it influenced him not only personally, but professionally.
Yeah. So the book also is talking about and showing images other than just fishing. I mean, that there's a terrific hunting picture of someone harvesting a moose, and there's pictures of gardening, and you were trying to reach beyond the thing that we all know about to sort of more show the entire region.
Yeah, there are two photo essay books that have previously been published that touch kind of broadly on the Bristol Bay region. One was Robert Glenn Ketchum's Rivers Life, which was published in 2002. And he covered broadly, you know, salmon, both subsistence and commercial. And then Hidden Alaska, which included some Bristol Bay in it, was published in 2010. But again, it focused principally on subsistence and commercial salmon activities. And I really wanted to get a broader sense of the importance of all the wild renewable foods that people rely on in the Bristol Bay region, and including the harvesting of, you know, gardens and berries and hunting and as well as trapping.
Mm-hmm. How long did it take you to gather all those pictures?
I spent about 5 years in the field. First photos were taken in July of 2011, and last pictures that are in the book were in September 2015.
Wow. So how do you finance something like that? Because it doesn't sound like you could really get enough money from the sale of a book to cover 5 years of work.
Oh, certainly not. So actually, my very first work was funded by selling off some photography gear I wasn't using anymore because I wasn't doing sports action photography. But then principally, it was three separate crowdfunding efforts. And from that, I received over 80 individual contributions from people, principally from Alaska, but also various locations in the lower 48.
Interesting. And then finding a publisher and going through the work of recruiting the writers and putting it all together, it's a huge labor of love, isn't it?
It is. I got a lot of help from Amy Gulick, who her book Salmon in the Trees, I really thought was effective in conveying the message that it sought to. And her publisher was Braided River, so I approached her to ask for suggestions on designing a project and approaching a publisher, and that's really what got it started. But selecting
the Salmon in the Trees, for folks who don't know about it, the title is referring to the fact that in Southeast Alaska and in you know, Kodiak in our region, that the ecology of the forest is fed by salmon who are coming up the upriver, and so the energy, the nutrients in the top of the trees comes from salmon. It's such a neat thing.
Yeah, and they've done genetic testing, and they can actually find traces of salmon in the trees, which is pretty cool. And, and of course, when you first see the title, it doesn't make any sense, but then when you learn the story of it, then it's just such a clever title.
It is, yeah. So she helped you figure out how to do this, because before you'd been an attorney, not a writer. Or a
correct. I had been doing photography and attorney as parallel lives for quite some time. And when I left behind the practice of law is when I decided I could devote myself full time to doing something like this project.
Mm-hmm. And how do you set out to do this? I mean, do you just sort of fly into Dillingham and sort of just look around, or do you start with a plan of like, how are you going to capture an entire region? Because it's such a big thing to pull into a book, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, one of the things I learned growing up and also since I've lived in Alaska and in dealing with Native communities is I did not want to fly into a community without having anybody there who knew me. Mm-hmm. And so the first steps were actually taken through connections through somebody that my wife worked with who had family in Naknek. Mm-hmm. And that opened some doors, and then that made more connections. The one time I approached, came to a village where I did not know anyone, I approached the tribal council first, told them why I wanted to come, what my purpose was, and asked them if they would support me coming and maybe help me meet some people. And that was successful, and that was with New Halen Tribal Council.
Did you have this wonderful experience of being sort of invited into a subsistence community and sort of getting to participate and you know, share in their world?
It was so incredibly heartwarming to go to a place. Once you're there and you're starting to meet people, as long as there's somebody there who can introduce you, there's a certain sense that you trusted. Mm-hmm. And once I was in the communities, I found them to be incredibly welcoming and generous. I would meet people and they would invite me to come to their homes and watch them process fish, and then invite me for a maké, which is a sweat, in their sweat house afterwards, and for dinner, and eventually, you know, every time I went to a village, I would come with a cooler full of some kind of produce, you know, fresh fruit or vegetables, something that they might not normally get, and invariably I would leave with a cooler full of smoked salmon or fresh salmon or something else. So it was just such a great experience to be out in the villages.
Yeah. So here's a question that's not necessarily on Bristol Bay, but as on something you just mentioned, which is having a sweat in a village. I'm a sauna enthusiast, but I have never been hotter than I've been in an Alaska Native village, where you just feel like your body is going to catch on fire, right?
I was in one sweat in Dillingham where they had a thermometer in, and it was me with three other Native gentlemen. And it was very clear they were trying to sweat out the white guy.
Yep, that's what happens.
And it was really hot and dry, and then they kept pouring water on the hot rocks. When I left, I saw the thermometer was at 230 degrees.
Yeah, that's insane.
Yeah.
Your blood is starting to literally boil. We're a little off topic, but we're talking about Bristol Bay today. And my guest on Outdoor Explorer is Carl Johnson, who's published this book, Where Water is Gold, Life and Livelihood in Alaska's Bristol Bay. And it's a gorgeous edition. And it has a foreword by none other than Sandra Day O'Connor. And the heart of the book is photography, it's sort of a broad range of pictures of Bristol Bay, but not just fish, also a lot of pictures of people and of just the waters and the scenery and you know, different seasons. And it's a really nice book, and congratulations on producing it. Carla, obviously we've gone the first quarter of the show here without talking about Pebble, because I think that in some sense there's a little bit of Pebble fatigue out there, but I know that that the Pebble Prospect and the potential that there would be a huge mine out in Bristol Bay is one of the things that got you involved in this region in the first place, right?
That's correct. Back in that past life, when I was an attorney, I was working for Trustees for Alaska and principally involved in a lawsuit they had filed against the state about the practice of exempting hard rock mineral exploration from public review. And I was funded for that case, and once the trial was done, I was done with the firm, but I wanted to still continue working on Bristol Bay. And it exposed me a lot more deeply to the story of Bristol Bay and the various issues and the different aspects of the culture and the way of life out there that I had not seen in previous books.
Mm-hmm.
So that really inspired me to go very broad and provide a deeper understanding over a period of multiple years to produce this body of work.
Did you see it as a mission sort of book where you're trying to emphasize the qualities of Bristol Bay in order to counter the Pebble Prospect, or was it more of a just celebration of the area? I mean, how does it fit in with your previous mission of actually being a litigant on this project?
Well, you know, it's very different in that when you're a litigant, you're an attorney, you are a strong advocate for your client. And in that case, it was advocating for subsistence users and tribes, and also one of our surviving members of the Alaska Constitutional Convention delegation, for a particular point of view. With this book, it was principally to tell the story about Bristol Bay, to celebrate the way of life in the region, but also as a way of showing what would be affected by the development of a mine. And that's why of the five essays that are in the book, only one of them touches on Pebble and focuses on the exploration and the grassroots activism that rose up against it.
Mm-hmm. You didn't really take a direct approach in saying, you know, we don't want this. You took more of an approach of saying this is a special area and here's why it's special.
That is correct. And it was also...
And why did you make that choice?
Because I felt that, again, to the Pebble fatigue issue, you know, people are very polarized out in the region. You'll hear people in ACTEC talk about how extreme the people are in Dillingham who are against the development of the mine. And people in general, just even aside from Bristol Bay, are seemingly more polarized. And I felt that if there were something that was more of a hard-hitting attack hit piece, people wouldn't get the message. They wouldn't want to learn more. But if you just tell the story about the region without being a strong advocate, you know, pebble bad, and just hammering people with that, it would give them more of an opportunity to realize what this region is about, what the way of life is. And there are some, you know, people, a lot of people say, well, people in Alaska already know the story about Bristol Bay. They know about the way of life mm-hmm. out there, but I don't think that's entirely true.
I don't think most Alaskans have been to Bristol Bay.
Yeah. And at most they might think, oh yeah, Katmai, that's in Bristol Bay, right? And mm-hmm. that might be the extent of it. So I really wanted people to be open to the story. And so that's mm-hmm. why I took that approach. And it was also, that was an approach that was also encouraged by Amy Gulick, because that was an approach she took with her story as well. I mean, the idea of telling about how important the salmon are to enriching the trees is a story about why it's a good idea to not log those trees, mm-hmm. because then the salmon can't be there to provide the nourishments that make those trees so healthy and so
right,
big.
Right. So did you reach out to the other side, sort of the other perspective, to get into the book?
I did, because early on when I drafted the script for my fundraising video, I made it very objective and very wanted to tell both sides of the story. So I did approach the Pebble Limited Partnership, public affairs people who also brought in Anglo-American Public Affairs, and sat down with them and had a meeting and talked about how I would like to work with them on getting access to the exploration sites to learn about, you know, the job opportunities that are there, what the economics are from the perspective
of
people who
work at. They must have been very suspicious since you've been an attorney on the other side of this.
I don't know whether or not they knew I was an attorney working on the case. You know, I wanted to leave that behind and just start fresh. And they were very supportive. They were interested. And I even suggested that, you know, perhaps if they knew somebody who was a good writer, they could contribute an essay kind of mm-hmm. explaining from their perspective mm-hmm. what they felt the potential for economic improvement was for the region. Ultimately, that never panned out. It just didn't happen. And when I did encounter people out in the field at fish camps or whatever, who I found were pro-Pebble, I would try to, you know, just kind of just talk to them first, starting with just learning about, your way of life. You know, tell me how's mm-hmm. fish camp going? Have you been mm-hmm. catching good fish? And you're just trying to just learn about their way of life. But once when they would find out that I had recently visited another fish camp where that person was very anti-pebble, then they became hostile because they thought that I was
because
anti-pebble.
Because it's still so polarized and still such a tough issue. Well, is it... one had the feeling that the project was dying because of the withdrawal of the big companies that had funded it, but it still seems to continue in terms of court action and stuff. Is it? Do you feel it that it's dead, or where do you think it stands now?
Well, it depends. You know, because there was the EPA had been working on its watershed assessment and had finalized a scientific document that assessed the value of the watershed. It had not, you know, this is one of the things the media gets wrong. I repeatedly see in 2418, the EPA put a halt to the mine. It's not true. Mm-hmm. The EPA had not actually reached the decision stage yet because Pebble and a partnership filed a lawsuit claiming that they had violated the Federal Advisory Committee Act by holding these non-public meetings.
I know,
meetings.
And we can get so far down the weeds on this. I just want to...
Yeah, so there's the legal side that continues mm-hmm. on, and now there's an administration that's already stated it's much more favorable to the permitting.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also the financial aspect, and there are a few reports that have been out recently that talk about Northern Dynasty Minerals, which is the Canadian firm that now still holds the claims, having pretty much no value mm-hmm. to its stock, and how they are there are financial concerns about investing in it, not only because of the extreme cost to get the mineral out of a low-grade ore in that area, but also the opposition to it and, mm-hmm. and the costs associated with fighting that opposition.
Yeah, and mineral prices are down at these days. And
correct.
So it's probably, if it comes back, it's probably far off in the future. Well, I want to take a few more minutes to talk about just the positive aspects of Bristol Bay that you probably learned about when you were working on your book. Talking with Carl Johnson in his new book is Where Water is Gold. How do you get around out there? You must get around like by boat most of the time. What sort of outdoors activities did you do when you were working on the book that kind of must have been a lot of fun?
Well, one of the more, boat is definitely one of them. One of the activities I went on was with a couple of gentlemen from Non-Dalton on a moose hunt up the Chilitno uh-huh. River, which flows into Lake Clark. And, you know, spent a few days with them out in the field, and they caught two moose during that time. And I encountered some challenges with, you know, falling into water and keeping my camera dry. And
I'm sure, yeah. And it rains quite a bit, too.
Yeah, we definitely had a bit of rain on that trip. And wintertime was always a lot of fun, although it was really challenging during the time I was out there because they had, you know, several low snowfall years in a row.
Mm-hmm.
So people weren't getting out with snow machines as much as they were with four-wheelers. But, you know, going out with people to check trap lines and going out and doing, you know, winter fishing and seeing how they fish under the ice with a gill net in the wintertime is really fascinating, how they do that.
So had you done this kind of a very remote kind of subsistence backcountry stuff before, or was this a new experience for you?
Well, I had been in remote places before, not doing cultural type photography, but just landscape wildlife photography.
Mm-hmm.
I was artist in residence for Gates of the Arctic in 2007, and that was entirely a backcountry patrol.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a canoe guide in the Boundary Waters Coonery Wilderness for a couple of years in northern Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
So being in the backcountry was something that
wasn't familiar to me. Yeah, you knew the skills, but being out with native folks, it's quite different, isn't it?
It's very different, and one of the things that's really challenging is just being sensitive to the fact how they might feel about you interviewing them and photographing them.
Mm-hmm.
One time for work of a kind of a long ongoing project I'm doing about the Brooks Range, I spent time with people at their hunting camp in the Drawn River Valley south of Anaktuvik Pass. Anaktuvik Pass, the Nunavut people have been so studied again and again by anthropologists because they were the last nomadic people in North America to settle into a settlement.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so they were so fatigued with being interviewed. I had to be very careful about how I spent time with them.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a little bit of that in Bristol Bay as well, but more so the sensitivities around the subject of pebble. There, if you're just there to just be out and learn from them and experience their way of life, they're very enthusiastic about that. They really like the idea of people wanting to understand how they live.
I think that that there's also this issue for journalist or photographer. When you're viewing subsistence activities, is you're seeing something that has a spiritual component, and to the extent that you just express it as being from your own worldview, your own perspective, you're kind of missing the point. And sometimes you get the sense of people trying to suss you out and figure out, are you really going to get it? And especially as a photographer, you could make sort of hunting activities look gruesome, right? You could make people not like what they're doing. And so they're putting a lot of trust in your hands.
I think that's true. And I think the important way to do that is that when you're out there as a photographer, you have to put the photography on the back seat. The front seat needs to be understanding and learning and listening to really appreciate what it is they're doing, how they're doing it, and why they're doing it. And then the photography has to just be ancillary to that. And then that way you're showing them the respect about being with them and having them welcome you into their life and into this very intimate activity that has a long cultural tradition. And you hear stories about how important it was for people to grow up in fish camp or to grow up, you know, working on a drift boat out and doing the commercial fishery in Bristol Bay. And you get a real sense of how important it is. And you have to keep that at the forefront more than the photography.
Yeah. Neat. Well, I think you've accomplished it and brought back some great pictures, too. I've been talking with Carl Johnson. His new book is Where Water is Gold, Life and Livelihood in Alaska's Bristol Bay, a gorgeous photography book on the Bristol Bay region, and not only the scenery, but the people and the subsistence lifestyle there, and with some great Alaskan writers, and also a foreword by former Supreme Court Justice Andrew Day O'Connor. Thanks for being with us, Carl.
Thank you so much.
Please stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. We're talking about Bristol Bay on today's show. And you can't talk about Bristol Bay without talking about salmon. And you can't talk about Bristol Bay salmon without talking about the commercial fishery for the sockeye in Bristol Bay, which is, I believe, like the largest salmon fishery in the world. And it's an amazing, rich and active fishery with a tremendous amount of history to it. And so had a friend in today to talk about that fishery, Chip Trinan, who has fished out there for 15 years and has kind of been around commercial fishing in Alaska. It sounds like just about every fishery you could do, eh, Chip?
Well, a lot of them. I haven't done too much in the trawling end of things, but done a variety of other fisheries and a lot in the coastal areas,
yeah.
Rather than the high seas. I did crabfish when I first started.
Headed out to you know, the season beginning down in Sitka with the herring, and then working through the summer, and I guess you get out to Bristol Bay like in early July or late June.
It'll be earlier in June, maybe you know, the 12th or the 15th of June, then we'll work through June 20th, maybe the 25th, depending on how the run comes in. You have to be pretty flexible all the time.
Okay, so it's pretty quick. I mean, you're really getting there when the fish are there and doing your work and not missing it very many minutes.
Yeah, you know, that's the advantage to that fishery. It's short and hopefully sweet. You know, you're looking at the 2 or 3 week peak, and then the tails where you can still make a little bit of headway on your catch.
Uh-huh.
But the peak is quite short and quite intense.
Yeah. So let's, for listeners who I suspect there are probably plenty of who really don't know anything about commercial fishing, tell us what drift salmon fishing is all about, how it works.
Yeah. Okay, so it's drift gill netting, and a gill net is essentially a passive net that the fish that are swimming, the net is set in a straight line, kind of hanging like a curtain. The fish essentially are traveling and bump into it and get stuck essentially by the gills.
Uh-huh.
And so they're captured in that way. In contrast to, say, something like a seining, purse seining, where you set a net around a school of fish.
It's kind of like a wall. Yeah.
Yeah, and then you purse up the bottom to mm-hmm. trap the fish. You're not catching the fish, snagging the fish in the web. You're
right.
They're still free swimming when they're in the net.
And in Bristol Bay, just because of tradition and the way the fishery was managed over the years, you're in fairly small boats. pretty competitive environment, right? I mean, you're trying to get up to a line and sort of and get your share.
Yeah, Bristol Bay is a real challenge in terms of the environment, and then your fellow fishermen. It's very competitive. In the drift net fishery, there's over 1,800 permits. Not all of them are used, and there are some regulations that allow two permits to be used on a single boat. But essentially, there's you get to be out there in the fresh air with, say, 1,200 of your fellow fishermen, fellow boats, and then, of course, two, three crewmen on each of those, as well as a skipper. Uh-huh.
And super fast-paced?
It can be. There are set openings, depending, and it depends on the return of fish. If there's a lot of fish coming in, then it'll be pretty grueling, and we'll be fishing an opening of 6, 8, 10, maybe more hours in a day, and maybe 2 days, two openings a day, and working hard. So you'll be getting a few hours of sleep. You finish the fishery, and then you have to get unloaded to a tender, and then you hope to get a few hours sleep and then get back out there and start put your net out and pick fish again.
How much skill is involved in this?
As for crewmen, it takes a crewman 2 years to get adept at picking fish, I'd say, in general.
Taking them out of the net.
Yeah, and picking the fish out of the net because they are tangled up in a gill net.
Mm-hmm.
They have to be extracted, and you want to extract them with the least damage to the fish and the least damage to your fingers.
Right.
so you can continue to fish. You want to keep your crew healthy.
You're right, right. And what about for the skipper and where, orienting the boat and where to put the net and this competitive aspect? I mean, I imagine there's some people good at it and maybe some who aren't.
Oh, absolutely. And there are different techniques of fishing, of course, too. The classic Bristol Bay scene is just a mass of boats charging all around, and you're on line, essentially the regulatory line that where fishing is allowed on one side and not on the other.
Uh-huh.
And when the tide is coming in so that the fish are flooding into the district, the best place to be is closest to the line. And we have the GPS equipment that we use now with plotters allows us to be essentially right on the line. And there's it's pretty chaotic. The state troopers, Fish and Wildlife Protection, are most of the time out there to kind of monitor the fishery. They're essentially traffic cops in a lot of ways, and they make it a little more orderly than it would be otherwise.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it could be stressful, but it also sounds like it could be pretty fun.
Well, there is a kind of a perverse fun to being able to do that.
Especially if you win.
That's exactly right. You always hope to do the best. But you get to have a lot of chances.
Uh-huh.
But nets get ripped up sometimes, and then you got to go in and get a new net. And, it's pretty stressful. And then when the tide goes the other direction, there's another stress, and that is getting swept out of the district. And then there's Fish and Wildlife Protection is looking for that too. If you end up getting swept out by the tide and you go beyond the line,
then you're in trouble.
Then you get to you're at risk for sure.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So what is the main thing for you that makes you want to be a fisherman? I mean, what's sort of the attraction of this career? I mean, some of what you're saying makes it clear, but I'm just curious as to why, why choose this way of life?
That's a good question. I When the days are good, they're really, really good. And when they're bad, they're really, really bad. So
the cold, I guess, not catching anything, that kind of thing?
Yeah, cold and heavy weather, you know, when you're out there and it's blowing 40 or 50 and the waves are crashing over the boat.
And you gotta go pretty much regardless because the fish come when the fish come, right?
That's essentially it. You know, you try to find the... some kind of a balance between safety and being successful.
Mm-hmm.
I was probably, when I was more in debt, I was probably a better fisherman.
Right, you're hungrier, right? So, yeah. But I mean, you also get to be outdoors and sort of being part of the real Alaska.
Well, that is probably one of the things that I enjoy the most is some of the places that we get to go. And you see the incredible mountains and the forces of nature in lots of different ways. You know, you see various wildlife, and you know, and get to go to a lot of places that otherwise no one would be at, and right. you would never be able to see them.
Yeah. So tell us about Bristol Bay itself. I mean, what's it like out there?
Bristol Bay is a very dynamic environment. It's shallow water, maybe similar to Cook Inlet, only bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And you get big tides. You have very big tidal changes.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the shallow water, so you get the mud flats and uh-huh. sand exposed at low water, and if you're not careful, you can end up being high and dry. They call the guys that end up on the beach at a low tide potato farmers.
I imagine there's hardly anybody out there other than the commercial fishermen. I mean, and that you guys are like pretty much take over these communities when it's going on.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, there are local residents in the communities of Bristol Bay. The major ones are Dillingham and Naknek, and then you know, there's really four major areas where the most of the fish come in, and then there's a kind of a fifth area in Togiak where there's a smaller run, and that's a little bit more restricted. But you have the Nooshigak Bay area, and then the Naknek Kwijak area, and then Igigik and Ugashik.
Mm-hmm. And the fish are running for these rivers, and once they get to the rivers, then they're the subsistence and the sport fishermen's business. You guys are done.
That's essentially it. But the sockeye runs are abundant enough so that we really don't have much of a conflict with mm-hmm. any of the subsistence or sport people. And we've really worked well together, in my mind, on some of the environmental issues with the sport fishermen. Really, the sockeye salmon kind of drive the ecology of the aquatic habitat. And sockeye come in and provide feed for the rainbows to grow yeah. big and strong. And I think probably the sport fishermen like them a lot better than fishing for sockeye. You know, there's so many that, you know, it's the uniqueness of being able to catch the rainbow and king salmon, too. Mm-hmm. I think the sport fishermen like that. As commercial fishermen, we catch some king salmon, but not very many, and so I think there isn't a nearly as big a conflict between sport and commercial like you can witness here in the Cook Inlet region.
Yeah, and we're going to learn more about sport fishing Bristol Bay a little later in the show. But I just want to thank you, Chip Trunin, for coming in and telling us about commercial fishing in Bristol Bay. I'm ending up very envious. It sounds gorgeous and fun and exciting.
Well, you know, I've tried to quit a number of times, but fishing in general, but I haven't been able to do it, so I'm still out there.
That's great. All right, stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues. Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and today we have been talking about Bristol Bay. This gorgeous new book has come out with photographs by Carl Johnson, and we heard about commercial fishing, and so maybe saving the best for last. Bristol Bay and the Bristol Bay region is one of the most famous and desirable sport fishing locations in the world, and we have a guide and lodge owner, John Homan, who has the No-See-Em Lodge and has been out there pretty much all your whole life, right, John?
That's right.
So you you kind of grew up fishing on some of the best fishing streams in the world.
I did. My parents were school teachers down there in Bristol Bay in two different villages, and I spent my childhood on the banks of the Nooshigak and Kwajak rivers, catching trout, salmon, everything.
Yeah, that sounds kind of idyllic.
It was, yeah.
And now you're running the lodge, what's your day like running a lodge out there? I mean, you've got a limited number of guests, and you're sort of taking them out to find the best spots to fish.
Exactly right. It's a full service business. So, number one, it's all about making these people happy, and doing a quality, safe operation. So. We're trying to catch trout, salmon, you know, you name it. Sport fishing is what we do. But like any service business, the day starts early and it goes until late. You know, it's just everything from wake up to lights out for bedtime and everything in between. So I've got a staff of 12, and I can accommodate 12 guests in a week. And so I do everything. I guide, I fly, I run the entire business. So for me, it's a very intense 4 months, and I love doing it. I'm raising my family there. And as I said, I was raised in that environment. So yeah. I think it's a great place to grow up.
Something you said just sort of made me a click with the economics of this. You've got 12 staff and 12 guests, so one-to-one. And you've got airplanes, and you've got a lodge, and you've got to move everything out there. This is not an inexpensive operation.
Oh God, no! It's crazy. Yeah, the overhead is just phenomenal. And my wife and I, we struggle with trying to just make enough to keep doing it at times. You know, and things are actually doing better in the economy, and for our clientele. I think they're feeling better, so bookings are up. But I tell you, in 2007, 2008, we just barely kept the doors open. Mm-hmm. It was a real struggle. And, you know, and going back, the business started in 1975. My dad started it, and it was more of even call it tax write-off back in those days. He didn't intend on starting a sport fishing lodge, so it got the name. No-See-Em based on some of that, but
in other words, there was no actual lodge.
There was no lodge. That's right. He wanted to buy a boat, and so he needed a business, and so here it is. No-See-Em. So, you know, 40 plus years later, we're stuck with the name,
which is not a good advertising.
No, you're right. Advertising, it's tough with that sort of a name, but we've made it through all of that, and for the first 40 years, his business was trying to figure out what he was doing, you know, where do you go find these fish and how do you do it safely? And he was definitely a pioneer in that area. And I'm kind of trying to follow in his footsteps. He managed to do it safely for 40 years and I'm trying to run the same sort of an operation.
Yeah. What an interesting challenge and what a great lifestyle for you and your kids to be able to live in the real wilderness and be surrounded by this landscape and this amazing fish resource.
Untouched, you know, you look at the state of Alaska, and that's one area that is still like it was hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And I've seen in my lifetime, I've seen a lot of changes out there, and I've seen people, the number of people definitely has increased, and I haven't seen a lot of development. I've seen improvements to the way of life for a lot of the village people that live there full time. And my business and my life out there has changed pretty dramatically in the last 20 some years. But overall, it's like it always was. And the fishing, you know, is a great example of that. It hasn't decreased. We haven't seen a drop off like we have in some of the other parts of the state. And in some cases, it's actually improved over the 70s and 80s. It's really gotten better. And a lot of that obviously is conservation. People have figured out that you can't just keep everything, you can't kill everything, and you need to protect what's there. Mm-hmm. And I see it happening more and more, so it's really good to see.
Yeah. Well, tell me about the fishing. I mean, there's so many salmon. I mean, I've heard people talk about, yeah, I just like kept catching salmon. You know, it's getting bored and my arms are getting tired. It's kind of ridiculous story.
Like they say, you can walk across some of those rivers on the sockeye salmon.
Yeah.
And for 2 years now, we've had near record runs. And mm-hmm. so the numbers, the variety, it's phenomenal. It really is. And that's why a lot of my clientele are 15 to one guys. This will be his 27th consecutive year coming back. He's not seen a decline. He's seen phenomenal fishing that you can't find anywhere in the world. And the numbers, as I said, the sockeye, all species of salmon are doing very well in Alaska. But we are seeing declines all over the lower 48. But even in Alaska, you know, you look at the Kenai River King mm-hmm. Run, and the numbers are off.
And fish getting smaller, yeah.
Fish getting smaller, you know, stressed habitat. In some cases, maybe some overfishing, just pressure, mm-hmm. you know, from different areas. And I think our biggest issue out our way in recent times actually has been the threat of this mine, the Pebble Mine. And, you know, I think that is a threat that's real and could really change the lifestyle and the way of life for thousands of people and businesses like mine in Alaska. So I'm really happy that so many people are now aware of Bristol Bay through the fight that we've had over the years against this mining operation. But so far, so good. The environment out there is super healthy and doing well.
Yeah, it seems like the mine is not very likely a thing at this point, just because of what we hear. But it doesn't go all the way away.
I hate saying that.
Yeah, you don't want to let down your guard. Yeah. So I'm thinking that in terms of sport fishing, I mean, number one, the resource is so enormous. But another is, you've kind of got a natural rationing system, which is it's not that easy or cheap to get there, right?
It's so very difficult.
There's never going to be combat fishing in where you are.
That's true. That's true. The lack of a road system out there is going to keep it like it is now. And, you know, growing up in the village and knowing a lot of people that live out there full time, I understand the desire for some of the benefits and some of the advantages that a road system would bring. But I think that a majority of the people that are out there because there is no road system, because it is what mm-hmm. it is. And I think that's exactly right. That is why it is what it is, and it'll stay that way for a long time, I hope.
Yeah. So let's talk about the fishing sort of what folks are going after and what they can find.
Sure. Well, my business, we specialize in fly fishing. So my clientele come to me primarily to catch rainbow trout. Uh-huh. And Bristol Bay has the largest rainbow trout anywhere in the world. And these are all wild. There's never been any stocking of rainbows or really any fish out there. And so we're going to hop in an airplane every day. We've got about 30 different rivers that we can access. We're going to fly in, land maybe in a lake, maybe in a river. Sometimes we're going to hike maybe a mile in, and we're going to try to get to an area where the conditions, the rivers, everything is laid out just right to produce the rainbow trout. You know, and it's, if you looked at a map of Alaska and actually the entire world, there's kind of a narrow band of temperature and really environmental qualities that are required to produce rainbow trout. Mm-hmm. And this part of Alaska where we are, everything is perfect. We've got the food source, the environment, the temperature, everything is perfect. And the environment, as far as rivers, lakes, and streams, are set up perfectly to produce and sustain huge numbers of them. So we're going to go out there and we're going to fish with dry flies. We're going to fish with mouse pattern streamers, really anything that those rainbows are targeting naturally, we're going to try to imitate. Uh-huh. And so for a lot of my guests and for myself, it's almost like hunting. You're not going out there and really just hoping for the best. You're actively pursuing fish based on knowledge and based on what they're what you think they're eating, and you know, obviously it's fishing. So, yeah.
And I'm imagining these are going to be pretty savvy fishermen before they get there. They're not going to. It's not going to be a beginner, right? You're going to have somebody who really, probably knows quite a bit about fly fishing and is like going for something. No,
you'd like to think that, but you'd be surprised that we get a lot of people that have never fly fished.
Wow.
And they show up whether the trip was a gift or they came with somebody else or they want to get into fly fishing. It's actually a pretty good place to get into it because the numbers and the relative ease of catching these fish in comparison mm-hmm. to other parts of the world. Yeah. So it's not that they're dumb and it's not that it's very easy. If it was, people wouldn't keep coming back to do it. But
right. But
when you compare the fishing here with, let's say, Montana, it's pretty darn good.
Yeah. It's Outdoor Explorer, and I'm talking today about Bristol Bay and the amazing fishing out there and sort of getting into all things Bristol Bay today. And right now my guest is John Holman, who's the owner of the No-See-Um Lodge. And the size of these rainbows is sort of it's kind of off the charts in terms of what you would expect anywhere else. So I would think that would be the huge trophy. But people are mostly catch and release, I imagine, right?
All catch and release, yeah. That's right. For trout, we do fish for salmon as well, mm-hmm. and we do keep some salmon. But yeah, the main draw is the rainbow trout.
And it's basically that photo. Like if you have caught this enormous rainbow.
You got it. You got it. And yeah, that's the reason people spend the money to fly to Alaska mm-hmm. and pay to go out to this remote part of Alaska is the size. Let's say that you're fishing your average lower 48 river, a 20-inch rainbow is usually a trophy.
Yeah.
You know, up here, there's lots of rivers that we have where a 20-inch rainbow, it's a nice fish, but that's nowhere near what you're looking for. The Quijack River and Lake Iliamna system, the Naknek Lake and river systems produce rainbows into the mid 30-inch range, and I'm talking 20 to 25 pounds. Just
which is
enormous.
You don't even think of a trout being that,
no,
right?
That's really, the size of king salmon.
Yeah,
yeah, and these fish are so strong, and so it's.
So on a fly rod, that's like a real challenge and really, really
absolutely,
exciting.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely, and you typically aren't going to have the beginners bring in those kind of
right.
fish. You know, that's kind of the goal for many anglers is to land that rainbow over 30 inches.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them will spend a lifetime trying to do it. They'll hook them, they'll lose them, because you're right, it's very difficult to bring those fish in.
Yeah, I bet you have.
You know, honestly, my biggest landed rainbow is only 29 inches. I'm guiding.
Right.
I guide every day.
You don't
I'm
get to fish much, huh?
No, I really don't.
Yeah.
I don't.
Yeah. So it just struck me that you have to have a really good camera. I mean, if you blow that moment, that's like you
that's
really
right.
your name is really mud.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, waterproof camera. Yeah, yeah. If you miss out on it, it could be the once in a lifetime fish. Yeah, but you know, the average size rainbow is typically enough. I mean, our mm-hmm. many rivers. A 20 to 25 inch rainbow, that's a huge
still
rainbow.
An amazing
that's
experience,
still an,
yeah.
an amazing fish. It really mm-hmm. is. And so that's really the draw and what's keeping people coming back are the numbers and the relative size of the average is really,
yeah.
really pretty amazing still.
You grew up in the village and you live out there and you're raising your family now. What is the relationship like between the sport fishing industry and the subsistence fishermen and the sort of the native community out there?
In Bristol Bay, there's probably not a huge relationship. The sport fishing, as far as what I'm doing, we're catch and release primarily.
No pressure, yeah.
Right. And primarily subsistence fishing isn't for rainbow trout. You know,
right.
they're going after salmon. I don't currently live in the village. I grew up in the villages, mm-hmm. and you know, my summers are at the lodge. But from what I've seen out there, there really isn't a conflict between sport and subsistence fisheries at all. I know lots of the natives that live in our surrounding villages, and I think that they view what we're doing as sometimes a little bit strange, just that we're letting them all go. They've told me that many times. You know, why do you do that?
Don't play with your food.
Exactly,
right?
And a lot of them do. They believe that that's it's a strange thing to do. Uh-huh. But you know, I think that probably if there's any sort of relationship, it would be more with the commercial side, you know, because as the commercial fisheries are allocated fish, it can affect our sport fisheries quite a bit. I don't really see subsistence being any sort of a There's really no relationship between what we're doing and, mm-hmm. and subsistence, though.
So let's give some tips for our Anchorage listeners who may dream of, you know, having a fishing experience like this. And a lot of Anchorage fishermen, you know, they've been on the Kenai, they've been, you know, in the valley, and they've sort of had to do, like, with a lot of people. And maybe the dream is, like, get out there and do, like, what the high rollers get to do in Bristol Bay. Is right. there a way to, you know, are there times when it would be less expensive? Or what tips would you give to somebody who wants to do that?
Well, as you said, very expensive. And for somebody who doesn't have an extra $10,000 for a week of fishing, it's I can understand it's not possible, but of course there are ways to do it affordably, and one way is kind of a do-it-yourself thing. If you can get out to Bristol Bay, there's all kinds of companies that offer drop-off fishing, do-it-yourself mm-hmm. drop-offs. You can do float trips. There's actually places on the Nishigak Drainage where you can rent boats and do your own salmon fishing over there. But the bottom line is, it without an airplane, it's pretty hard to get around out there.
Yeah.
And so that's really the key. I think if somebody wants to target the best trout fishing in the world, then their best bet is to use a local air taxi and pick a few different locations and just go for it. Try it out.
Do you find a couple of airplanes on the best spots, or is the area large enough that you don't run into other people that much?
Oh, no. There's plenty of competition out there, I'm not sure exactly, but I'd say there's probably 25 to 30 other lodges similar to mine that frequent a lot of the same rivers. So we do find plenty of places where there's nobody, but when you hit those rivers that are really going full steam, the fishing is peak, you're going to see other anglers there. But it's never the Kenai. We're not going to see any, there's right. no combat, there's no arm-to-arm. It's you might see somebody 100 yards down the river, you might see them 50 yards down the river, but there's a separation that we haven't crossed that line yet where we're combat fishing.
Where you're bothering each other. Right?
Right. We haven't hit that point.
Yeah,
I hope we never do. I think once we do, I'm done with it.
Yeah. Well, that might be in another 50 years. Who knows?
I hope so.
Last thing would be timing. I mean, when are the very best times, and when is sort of shoulder or not or marginal?
You know, it's good all summer out there. That's the crazy thing. A lot of people think that you need to get out there when the salmon are there. But if you're going to target rainbow trout, you can catch them in June. You can catch them in September.
It might be easier when the salmon aren't around.
Well, it can be. Certain rivers, for sure. But, of course, once the salmon come in, things change. And a lot of the lake systems actually hold a lot more rainbows than the rivers do earlier. But once the salmon roll in, then the rainbows tend to drop in, and so the numbers increase. So for strictly rainbow fishing, I don't think it really matters much. But
okay.
If you want the combination, if you want to catch the salmon and the rainbows, you're looking June and July.
Yeah. Great. Well, thanks so much, John. This has been really interesting. It went by quickly for me. John Homan is the owner of the No-See-Em Lodge. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
And that's all for Outdoor Explorer today. I want to thank my other guests who you heard earlier in the hour. Carl Johnson's book has come out about Bristol Bay. I recommend it. Chip Trinan was with us to talk about commercial fishing in Bristol Bay. Eric Bork is our producer. Anna Duro is our assistant producer. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.